Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Although Astoria has significantly diminished as a maritime culture, the notorious reputation of the Columbia River Bar, without too much exaggeration, remains as the graveyard of the Pacific. A few hundred river and ocean vessels have sunk in or near the river's entrance the past couple of centuries, and nearly 1,000 persons have died. No records exist of the losses of indigenous native mariners who crossed the bar for millennia. The most manifest and renowned representative of that immense maritime toll is the decomposed steel skeleton of wrecked British four-masted sailing ship Peter Iredale, which was hurled onto Clatsop Beach 112 years ago today, October 25th, 1906, where it has remained, stuck in surf and sand like an extinct beast in a tar pit, a virtually open-air museum of maritime history visited by thousands of tourists from all over the world. A century of wind and water in consort with salt and sand have rotted Peter Iredale to rusted steel bones resembling a desert skeleton, hardly more than a skull remnant. Its graveside acts as a museum to the vanished era of windships and also as a symbol for the hundreds of vessels, sail, steam, and diesel, and crews that have perished in the waters around the Columbia River for more than two centuries, not counting the vanished mariners of the 20 millennia preceding Yankee Captain Robert Gray's claim of discovery of the river in 1792, which he named after his ship, Columbia Rediviva, which was itself named for Christopher Columbus, who bumped into the Western Hemisphere on his way to India 300 years earlier. Two of Gray's crew died crossing the bar in a ship's boat. A legend grew that Iredale's captain toasted his deceased ship with a glass of whiskey from a bottle rescued from the ship's battered corpse, and then turned around and walked away forever. Not true. What he actually did was salute its dying and surf-spasmed wreckage with a swallow of whiskey, then pass the bottle around to rescuers. Afterward, he and a mate pitched a tent near the beached steel corpse to keep looters off until its cargo was unloaded. A letter to the Oregon Historical Quarterly in March 1963 by Rowena L. and Gordon D. Alcorn says that, quote, Captain H. Lawrence and First Mate John W. Clayton camped on the sands of Clatsop Spit within sight of the ship to prevent any unauthorized visits, but a small party managed to board the ship at low tide. When the visitors attempted to return to shore, strong swirling eddies in the outgoing tide swept one of the men around the end of the ship and out to sea, the only casualty of the wreck. The body washed ashore later. The ship's stores and rigging were removed, the Alcorns wrote, but hope of salvaging the Iredale eventually was given up. The Alcorns wrote that by the evening of October 24, 1906, the Peter Iredale was just 28 days out of Santa Cruz when it ran into fog. It was still foggy, but a strengthening wind seemed to indicate that fog would be dissipated by morning. Then the ship could be turned toward the mouth of the Columbia River. And that was the Alcorns. Captain Lawrence, who had made the passage many times before, thought Iredale was about 50 miles offshore. He was considerably closer. Early on October 25th, they were still in a swelter of mist and fog, though a fierce gale was blowing, the Alcorns wrote. The ship was skimming along at a good clip when suddenly breakers were sighted. All hands were called to bring the ship about, but the strong southerly gale, combined with the force of the current and tide, drove the ship closer to shore. The Iredale was now wallowing broadside in the troughs of the combers. Then, with a grinding crash, the ship slammed down against a shelving bar of Clatsop Spit. The Alcorns quoted William K. Inman, who had been a member of the Cape Disappointment life-saving crew, which was located at Canby, Washington, in those pre-Coast Guard days, and was called out to rescue the Iredale's crew. Inman's rescue boat got across the Columbia River and over to the wreck, which was toppled over on its side in the surf. Its mizzen mast snapped. Other boats were already taking off the crew. Inman waded waist-deep into the surf and carried Captain Lawrence ashore from one of the boats. Inman smiled as he recounted what happened next, the Alcorns wrote. And what Inman wrote, Captain Lawrence had brought only three things with him from the wreck. In one arm he held the ship's log and sextant. In the other he clutched a demijohn of whiskey. When I sat him down on the dry sand, he thanked me very politely. Then he did a most surprising thing. Standing stiffly at attention, he peered sadly at the battered hulk. Then he solemnly and with great dignity saluted his ship. May God bless you, and may your bones bleach in the sands. And that was Inman, which they have since as one of the most visited shipwreck sites in the world. Relics of Peter Iredale, including its binnacle and a painting of the ship by a Chinese artist commissioned by a crew member, which was and probably still is a common practice among ships' crews, are in display at the Columbia River Maritime Museum in Astoria. On a personal note, I am a shipwreck survivor of a commercial albacore and Dungeness crabfish boat that capsized in the Columbia River Bar, F.V. Mermaid, that sank on August 29, 1972, crossing the bar with a load of crabs and crab pots. All four of us aboard survived, thanks to boats that rescued us, and the crabs got away. And now, a story about tomorrow, which I also wrote. In periods when most of the Earth's human inhabitants are frightened of almost everything, signs are looked for in the lights across the night sky. As in the long ago past, when human beings were tormented with their ignorance of the strange world that was their home, contemporary, modern, civilized women and men still see disasters projected by celestial phenomena such as comets, supernova, or odd alignments of stars or nearby planets, even common eclipses of sun or moon. Seeming portents or amplifications of terrible occurrences as earthquakes, tsunamis, erupting volcanoes, tornadoes, hurricanes and floods, famine and disease, wars, of course, bloody red Mars, or otherwise inexplicable misfortunes. Disaster essentially translates as a word as against the stars. So you might wish to take notice that 10 years from now, tomorrow, in fact, October 26, 2028, has been predicted that an asteroid will strike Earth on that date and perhaps wipe out all life and perhaps everything else on the planet. That dire prediction was originally made in 1997 by a group of astronomers, but so much despair and outcry greeted that foreboding forecast that a quick revision was made by other scientists. According to this recalculation of the data, quote, asteroid 1997X-11, unquote, will miss us by 600,000 miles. Yet those same revisionists reminded us that a killer asteroid will inevitably strike the planet someday. And that was it. End of conversation. No one seems to have spoken of it since. Asteroid 1997X-11 seems to have disappeared, at least in human retentive memory. Forgetting about the rogue asteroid has not altered its trajectory, nor was there any suggestion about the timing of its arrival in our extraterrestrial neighborhood altered. Only its distance from Earth was revised. And of course, Earth has been bombarded by other space debris, including asteroids, for millions and billions of years. Colliding comets have been said to have been a source of water. Meteors and meteorites hitting Earth are commonplace. A giant meteor is claimed to have wiped out the dinosaurs. A more recent meteor blasted a Siberian Russian forest 100 years ago. Fragments of at least one asteroid that apparently ricocheted off Mars struck this planet a million or so years later. The fragments were found in a desert, which is what Mars is now, but might not have been then, prior to its own likely fate of climate change and global warming. Perhaps despite deliberate collective amnesia, there must obviously be a few humans aware that asteroid 1997 X-11 is coming our way. That could possibly explain the feral recklessness of our renowned misanthropist Donald Trump, whose demented amorality might be inspired by a recollection of the asteroid impact warning 2 decades ago at the cusp of the millennium. And now, October is Domestic Abuse Awareness Month, and also the 30th anniversary of the original Clatsop County Women's Crisis Service. And so for today's program, You Are Not Alone by Karen Millen. Domestic violence sounds like an oxymoron, the juxtaposition of two absolute opposites that contradict each other in a joining that startles the mind. Home ought to be a safe place, but it isn't. The words domestic violence, so unsuitable to each other, indicate a schizophrenic condition that is pervasive in our culture. However, we are not alone. Domestic violence is an integral part of most cultures that reside on Mother Earth, our home. It affects us all, every one of us. Whether we choose to talk about it or keep it hidden, our shared experience binds us in one universal wish. We don't like it one bit, and we want to see it eliminated. No small task. Eliminating violence from our society is the major goal of the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence and the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. These coalitions provide assistance to programs that serve victims of domestic and sexual violence, such as the Clatsop County Women's Resource Center, and their purpose is to change societal conditions that cause violence to exist. Awareness of the problem is the first step in dealing with the cure. Violence against women won't subside until public attitudes change. A sense of entitlement is a major cause of violence against women and children by men. Many males believe they have the right to get what they want from women, even if it includes rape, torture, mutilation, sexual slavery, incestuous and extrafamilial child sexual abuse, physical and emotional battery, deprivation, sexual harassment, genital mutilations, unnecessary gynecological operations, forced motherhood, forced heterosexuality, forced sterilization, psychosurgery, abuse of medical experimentation, cosmetic surgery, and other mutilations in the name of beautification. Jane Caputi and Diana E.H. Russell coined a new word in a Ms. Magazine article that best describes this gruesome list of violent behaviors against women. They called it femicide, which is sexist terrorism motivated by hatred, contempt, pleasure, or a sense of ownership of women. It happens all the time. It is estimated that a woman is battered every 15 seconds in America. It is the single largest cause of injury to women. These figures are from the United States Department of Justice, which reports that more than one-third of women homicide victims over 15 are killed by a male spouse or boyfriend. The Journal of the American Medical Association states that 50% of the families where the wife is being abused, the children of that family are also abused. Until recently, law enforcement and judicial systems have viewed spousal abuse as a private matter and have been hesitant to intervene or treat domestic assault as a crime. Violent crimes against women have escalated in recent decades, say authors Caputi and Russell. We see this escalation of violence against females as part of a backlash against feminism. This doesn't mean it's the feminism. Patriarchal culture terrorizes women whether we fight back or not. Still, when male supremacy is challenged, that terror is intensified. Women who stepped out of line in early modern Europe were tortured and killed as witches. Estimates range from 200,000 to 9 million killed. Today, such women are regarded as deserving whatever happens to them. And that was Caputi and Russell. The statement of philosophy of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence recognizes that the root causes of this violence stems from a belief in the supremacy of one sex over the other that is legitimized by a complex series of institutional and social arrangements that define and treat women as substitutes. It is painful for most women to think about men's violence against us as individuals and collectively, because the violence we encounter and the disbelief and contempt with which we are met when we speak out is so often so traumatic and life-threatening that many of us engage in denial or repression of our experiences, state Caputi and Russell. However, to quote them again, we must demand an end to the global patriarchal war on women. All women have the right to freedom from violation, to their own self-determination. We must all collectively and internationally take on the task of formulating strategies of resistance to the massive and formidable horrors that confront women and children everywhere. We must eliminate violence from our lives. And that was by Karen Malin, You Are Not Alone. She was director of Clatsop County Women's Crisis Service for 7 years and also served on the Astoria City Council. She wrote this article for the North Coast Times Eagle in 1990. And I'd like to read a poem by Marge Piercy, For Shelter and Beyond. For battered women, battered by the fist of your keeper, by the nailed boots of the man, drunk on the bottle or the booze of his will, by the angry man, by the self-pitying man, by the man kicked by those who can afford to pass on rage. For battered women, battered by hunger, by poverty, by bills coming in with the old bills unpaid and the phone turned off and the children with no shoes to wear to school. For battered women, battered by the rapist you thought your friend, by the rapist your uncle, the rapist in every man who uses women like something he can wipe himself on. For battered women, battered by birthing methods invented for doctors' profits, with your baby yanked out of you strapped down, battered by social workers prying, battered by jail, battered by divorce court, battered by electroshock, battered with drugs that slow your body and snuff your mind. For battered women, battered by insults on the corner and on the job, by the lack of love, by the loss of love, by the rancid garbage abuse that come to the aged, by the death of children, by the death of respect for you and who you are, battered but alive, women ready to give birth again to hope, ready to midwife hope for other bleeding women. And that was by Marge Piercy, For Shelter and Beyond. And now, voting at home will help save our democracy. All 50 states should follow the example set by Oregon and Washington. And this is written by Phil Kiesling and Sam Reed. The single best way to increase voter turnout, abolish the polling place. A century ago, the direct election of senators sounded audacious, too. But in 6 states, it's already true that more than 12 million voters don't need to traipse to polling places on election day or apply for absentee ballots. The U.S. Postal Service delivers our ballots automatically several weeks before each election. Voters can mail their marked ballots, sometimes even postage paid, or take them to one of hundreds of official ballot collection sites. Since most voters choose the latter option, vote at home is more accurate label than vote by mail. At many locations, voters can also receive replacement ballots, update their voter registration, and get language or other assistance. For those so inclined, some sites still have voting booths. Oregon rolled out its system in 1998 after voters overwhelmingly approved a ballot measure. Washington finished its county-by-county approach in 2012, while Colorado's first vote-at-home election took place in 2014. Voters today also enjoy this system in 27 of Utah's 29 counties and more than 40 counties in North Dakota, Nebraska, and California. Oregon and Washington were not battleground states in 2016, but even so, had every state matched our 80% turnout of active registered voters, 15 million more votes would have been cast nationwide. Vote at home shines even brighter in lower turnout midterm and primary elections. Both Oregon and Colorado exceeded 70% turnout in 2014 among registered voters, compared with the national average of 48%. in the 41 states where most ballots were cast at traditional polls during the 2018 party primary cycle, the median turnout rate was a paltry 22%. In voted home states, it was 38%. Numerous studies reveal what's intuitively obvious about these additional voters. Automatically sending every voter a ballot shows little to no turnout effect among already motivated partisans. The real beneficiaries are younger and less partisan voters, many of whom feel little allegiance to either party. Voted home's power derives from it being an opt-out rather than an opt-in election system. Election day realities for other voters, bad weather or traffic jams, work schedules and family obligations, do not thwart our voters in exercising their most fundamental of rights. Polling place lines, gone. Photo ID laws, rendered moot. Election integrity is ensured by checking every voter's signature on the return envelope against voter registration records. Recounts in close elections are far more credible because they are based on paper ballots directly marked by voters rather than software code or machine-generated receipts. Scarce taxpayer dollars are not needed to buy expensive, supposedly next-generation voting machines, which will cost an estimated $100 million in Ohio alone. A well-designated voted-home system saves tax dollars, even after postage costs and staffing ballot return and voter assistant facilities. A recent Pew study of Colorado's first voted home election in 2014 found a cost savings of approximately $6 per voter. The voted home system gives voters more time and flexibility to study all the candidates and issues, including down ballot races. They can cast more informed ballots while creating new democratic rituals, joining friends to drop off their ballots, or voting with children and family members around their dining room tables. Ah, yes. But isn't such a system an open invitation to fraud and coercion? Well, election mischief is certainly possible in any system. Oregon has only 24 cases after 20 years and 100 million mailed-out ballots. None have been organized, much less consequential. Washington and Colorado's experiences are similar. Remember, too, that nary a whiff of meaningful fraud occurred in the fiercely fought 2016 election, in which a record 33 million Americans voted with mailed-out ballots. We would argue that there are bigger dangers to election integrity in the single software hack that might affect thousands of votes or the paperless votes that can't be properly recounted than in the would-be election thief who must risk years in prison for every forged or coerced ballot. Consigning the traditional polling place to the same electoral scrap heap as hanging chads and vulnerable voting machines would not be easy. Many will continue to confuse a familiar and to some beloved ritual of American democracy with its essence, which is voter participation. Blind partisanship is an even bigger problem. Each of us has faced fierce criticism from our respective party colleagues for promoting a reform that would supposedly advantage our partisan foes. And within each major party are factions that clearly prefer low turnout elections, especially in party primary contests. At times, we both miss the traditional polling places, but giving up those Norman Rockwellian memories, real or imagined, of crunchy autumn leaves and smiling neighbors is a meager price to pay for a more inclusive system. When every voter receives and a lot more casts a ballot, the more democratic we make our society. When more of us participate, we are better able to hold our politicians and ourselves accountable. Let's get voted home in place in all 50 states. It's not the only solution, but it's an important one to help revitalize our democracy, which for far too many Americans has devolved into a spectator sport. And that was Voting at Home Will Help Save Our Democracy by Phil Kiesling, a Democrat who served as Oregon's Secretary of State from 1991 to 1999 and is chairman of the National Vote at Home Institute, and Sam Reed, a Republican who served as Washington's Secretary of State from 2001 to 2013. And now, as a this program's final aftershock, Our Hair Trigger World, which I wrote. Until now, the Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962 has been the closest known or at least acknowledged brush with total nuclear war. Donald Trump's decree this past weekend that he intends to pull the USA out of a nuclear arms treaty with Russia as the immediate show of a renewed Cold War and a vastly more dangerous arms race than that which convulsed the last half of the 20th century. That near miss with Holocaust 56 years ago this month foreshadowed the real possibility of nuclear confrontation and confirmed beyond doubt that humanity inhabits a hair trigger world. It might seem an ironic surprise that the days of 1962 correspond with this 2018 calendar. For me personally, the missile crisis began on my younger brother's 19th birthday on Monday, October 22nd that year, when President John F. Kennedy announced over national television networks the presence of Russian nuclear missiles in Cuba a week after they had been discovered by a U-2 spy plane. And it nearly ended with mutual superpower triggering of their doomsday weapons a week later on Saturday, October 27th, which was my mother's 50th birthday. It is now supposed that humanity was not as close to obliteration as everyone thought, but at the time it suddenly seemed that ancient and recent prophecies of world suicide were about to be realized. There was hysteria, of course, but mostly a sense of mass dread. Stores in the U.S. were cleaned out, but for the most part, people went to church or stayed home to watch the apocalypse televised. A major pivotal point in the crisis occurred today, October 25th, 1962, at the United Nations, when American UN Ambassador Adlai Stevenson forced the Russian delegate to acknowledge the presence of Russian missiles in Cuba, which turned world opinion against the Soviet Union. The myth is that America made Russia blink at the brink, but this claim overlooks what most likely did actually happen, that civilian leaders and diplomats on both sides hastily agreed to stop the onrushing horror of their rapidly escalating militaries prior to Armageddon. My mother, Josephine, died 10 years ago at age 95. Her younger son, my brother Bill, celebrated his 75th birthday this past Monday. And this is Michael McCusker.